So I'd like to welcome any questions or anything that you'd like to share to start with today.
One is, I got stuck on the example you gave yesterday about the person who loves macaroni, and then they come home at night and ask the other person to make the macaroni. And I don't know, it sounds nice.
Yeah.
Like nothing I would want to fix.
Okay. Yeah? Okay. So, two questions. One, she says is easier. That yesterday, when I gave the example about macaroni, so in case you were asleep, I'll repeat that example. That idea was, it was an example of where, through my conditioning, macaroni is a sign of love, or whatever, new shoes, or driving the car, or whatever, is a sign of love, or a sign of freedom, or whatever, your dream. Of fulfillment. And she said, so the example was, then we go home after a hard day and we demand macaroni in order to trigger the feeling of being loved. And she's hearing how nice it would be to have a hard day and go home and have someone make macaroni. She doesn't feel anything to fix there. And so, yes, also. I tried to mention that too. But we covered a lot. We opened so many cans of worms, so to speak. We opened so many threads. So sometimes we can have a really lovely kind of communication where we can ask, or someone just knows, wow, you had a hard day, you want some macaroni? and it works. It does trigger a feeling of being loved, and that's exactly what we need. Because we're really tired and it was a hard day, and it's just, even though it was a hard day, I'm loved, and that's what matters. And then we come into a kind of realignment. So it can be a wonderful kind of communication, a wonderful kind of living, harmonious living. But when it is either... I don't quite feel that confidence with you to just ask, and you don't know me that well, or there's some resentment between us or something. And so why isn't she making me macaroni? Doesn't she know I like macaroni? And that's all I'm asking. I've given her so much. Can't she just make me some macaroni? Like, it becomes, instead of direct, it comes into an indirect, self-sabotaging almost. Like, the lollipop that we're sucking on is suffering rather than an openness to be loved. We're sucking on a lollipop of resentment, or I don't get what I need to feel loved. So when it comes into manipulation or pushing or not openness, not trust, that somewhere in there could be that love, and we just need to take our time to find that. When it's demand. And when it's really clinging to a sense of lack, like nobody loves me and I'm just asking for macaroni. But the way of asking is not actually open. That's when it causes mostly all our troubles. So the macaroni itself is not a problem. Our conditioned response to macaroni is not necessarily a problem if we just take it for what it is. It's my Pavlov's dog way. Do you know the experiment of Pavlov? Okay. It's my Pavlovian way of accessing some openness. And sometimes I'm so tired and I'm so feeling isolated or whatever that it's really nice to have some help to find my way back to openness. And great. When it can really be freely given. Or, and freely asked, even. Yes. I agree. It's not necessarily something to fix. If we take it for what it is. When we dramatize the whole thing, we believe I'm actually not loved. And the proof is that no one has made me macaroni. And in that moment, we feel like no one ever made me macaroni. Even though maybe yesterday they did or something. But in that moment, we're sure. Because we're sucking that lollipop of lack. Lacky pop. So there can be times in our lives where it's much more important that we have a sense of being able to ask for what we feel we need and to get a response. So it's like regrowing our interdependence, regrowing a resonance, a healthy interdependent humanity. So we've been kind of conditioned to believe and act, pretend that we are separate individuals. And as a culture also, the mainstream culture. And so part of the spiritual path is recovering the actual fact of interdependence, that we do resonate together, that we're made physically, or whatever made can imply something, but like our neurology, our blood chemistry, our mind and body depend on each other and depend on being met. And then when there's kind of enough of that being met, so this morning held and ground were the words, being met, we naturally find our original authentic voice moving that may be in disagreement with what my friends are saying. So there's a tension of belonging. We can experience enough belonging that then our independence also moves. Or it could be we experience enough independence that we start to realize we belong and we participate together. We are a togetherness. We are not in isolation. So then it can be that we're in a different time of our lives. It doesn't necessarily need to be macaroni. At a certain time of our life, it might need to be macaroni. That might be the medicine. Macaroni, macaroni, macaroni. And then it's like, macaroni with pesto. Yeah, what a great idea. I never thought of that. Instead of, I don't like pesto, or whatever. For a time period, it can be a bit of a process where the asking for, what is it that I need? And who can I be heard? Is there a response out there? And being met is important. For the yeses, yes macaroni and no pesto. That can be important. It sounds babyish, and maybe it is. And still, that doesn't mean it's not needed. We think that we're adults. We have big bodies. And gradually, as we get practiced at independence, interdependence, having needs as something that is part of life and that life sort of responds to, sometimes through another person, sometimes through myself, sometimes through patience, not getting what I thought I needed, and something else happens, or eventually it happens. That we kind of, eventually, we kind of then rather hang out with the feeling of being loved than go through that whole transaction about macaroni. And then we might make macaroni or not. We're free to make macaroni, to eat it, to not eat it, to never eat it again. But we're rather hanging out with being the feeling of being loved. So there's the gap that we came to yesterday, that maybe I'm loved, but I don't feel loved. Maybe I'm free, but I don't feel free. And it's true. It's important to have that honesty. So ultimately, that idea is we're already free. But our experience of reality is not free. And it's important to stay honest about both. So maybe our personal experience is, maybe it's true that I'm already free, and my day-to-day experience is a lot about not feeling free. And to accommodate these two possibilities, or these two maybe realities, we could say, these two honesties, two streams of honesty. Maybe I'm actually already free, but or and I don't know it. Or who I think I am doesn't experience that. It's the hard part of the path, to accommodate both honesties. Our tendency would be to, if I hear I'm already free, either I'm like, yay, I don't have to deal with all that shit that I know I'm in the middle of. I can kind of pretend it's not here. It's not mine. The Buddha said it's not mine. So kind of that kind of childishness, like, yay, I'm free because so-and-so said so. What a relief. But the good part of this, maybe I'm already free, is that it calls into question the deep belief that's emotionally charged that something's deeply wrong with me. Maybe it isn't. So that's the good side of that. And then, whoa, I have so much shit to deal with. It's partly true and partly not true. You've tried dealing with it and you haven't been able to. Maybe there's another way. Maybe it's not through dealing with it that there's something that gets resolved. So one hard part is, if I'm already free, then what's wrong with me? Like, why am I still so acting so unfree? I get enraged because the teapot is empty or something like that. Or I just feel crushed, or I feel whatever. My mind doesn't stop racing when I ask it to, ever so kindly and spiritually. My family members keep embarrassing me, or whatever. So if we can be willing to enact interdependence, like a healthy resonance with a person or in whatever, a community of two or more, we could be willing to enact that in order to bring out our feeling of belonging, bring out our feeling of being loved. And then we get the taste for being loved and we just stay there. And we can also be willing to enact the independent side, the freedom of choice, the inner authority, etc. Kind of with a sense of humor, knowing I'm enacting something in order to bring out an innate quality, something that's true in potential. And then I stay with that love of freedom. I stay with that freedom. I get the taste of freedom, and it doesn't need to be enacted to reassure me that, yes, I am free. Freedom is. Love is. And so we can start to even let it fall apart further from staying true to being loved and being free, staying true to that felt experience, to just love and freedom, rather than I am loved and freed. But it is a process that we sometimes could feel humiliated to have to go through. And that's what makes it hard. We want to be perfect already. And so if I hear about perfection and I recognize I'm not it, it just slays. It just like, it's so hard for us to accept. We want to give up or pretend to be already there instead of the hard work of so much potential and so much work to be done. Already free before you even start, and work on it. Okay, that's one question. Second question. Or if we just pause, and does anyone want to ask, clarify, repeat, review, share so far?
About this or something else?
About this. This was already like compact Dharma talk. We could stop here, but that's just question number one. So it's good if you want to clarify anything or share anything. And I just want to express appreciation for yesterday, the people who dared to speak out in the group. It was really great to kind of warm up that that's possible.
Well, I think it has to do with what you said, talking of imperfection. So I just want to share that I feel very imperfect at the moment because I find it very difficult to follow you.
Yeah.
You seem to... I feel like I came into the middle of a retreat that's already going. And it's like you're like flying so fast, and it's very hard for me to just land here and follow you. Mm. So I feel like I need a little bit slowing down and maybe... a warning. Now I'm going to go really fast, so I can just kind of, okay, so I'll just stay with what I heard before. So I got about 5% of what you said this morning and now.
So I agree that it's going fast, but it's not my fault. It's not me who's going fast. Already, like on the way here, I was like, whoa, that's the notes for the Dharma talk? Seriously? It's like a day 5 Dharma talk on day 1. Okay. So I would just ask you to feel where some part of you is going that fast and to let internally let that conflict, let them make friends with each other. The part that's going fast, the part that's like, ah, you're making me feel small. 5% is a lot. Also, maybe if... we can just check. So in the time of a Dharma talk, it can be easy to feel like, okay, now she's going to give us some content that we're supposed to capture and then like keep safe in the suitcase or something. And maybe that could be, but maybe also that's not something that I'm that interested in myself personally. And so maybe a question is more like, what is... your shift that you want and need to happen, though you don't know how to make it happen. But that you, that shift, the inner shift that you love and somehow know familiarly, but don't control, which we talked a little bit, we started to talk about yesterday with the question of difference between happy, unhappy, difference between same situation, happy, unhappy. For example, what makes the difference and what is the shift? And you talked very clearly that other people would have been like, oh, how does he know those words? So it's easy for words to trigger a sense of lack and a lack of getting it or a lack of clarity or something. But maybe there's something about almost like being on a ship here with the sort of creaking ropes and winds and sails, and more like we're together in a ship on a journey. And on the way, someone might tell stories to pass the time. And it's not unmeaningful, but it has its place. It doesn't do the journeying. It accompanies the journeying. this storytelling. And I do have a simple story to tell today, too. So. Okay. Question two.
So, there's this layer of the self, of myself, which is, like, not one of the noisy layers that go around, like, I'm not good enough, I'm not loved, or whatever. It is, like, a very quiet and kind of diligent layer that is really absolutely certain that the thing we are here to accomplish, and also like here, is to fake it well enough to deceive you and everybody and myself as well. And it just, so things kind of go through this layer, and it's like, yeah, okay, I mean, all the talk about honesty, and it can absorb it as part of the deceiving that we're doing, and that it's so fine.
Do you think that you deceive me?
No.
Okay. Can I repeat your question louder? Okay. And then we can continue.
And deceive is the GS.
When we get there, yeah, you can help me. Let me get back to the, okay, what did you say? Okay. So she's saying that in addition to whatever other layers that might be noisy layers that are saying I'm not good enough or not loved or whatever, there's this quiet layer, and she used the word diligent, so that means like sort of, it doesn't really ever stop. It kind of keeps going. And this layer is certain that whatever we're here and here to accomplish, was that the word you used? Is to deceive them, including this person, teacher, and myself. That's what we're here for. And so deceive is what?
Le remote.
And I asked her if she thinks, because we know each other for some years now, fairly well. Having been through a lot, okay, I said, do you think you deceive me? And she took some time checking, and then she said no. So some uncertainty, but actually, no, I don't think I deceive you. She said to me. Okay, so is there a question? Do you see your own honesty in just what you've said?
Yes.
Do you feel the patience for that? Or what could help some patience with that?
I don't understand.
When your honesty notices that there's some place, so it's a layer. It's not everywhere. And all that it has going for it is certainty. That's the strength of that layer. It's certain that we're here to fake it. That's the only thing there could be. But you see that layer. There is seeing and feeling of that layer. There's acknowledging of it. And you can even put that into words, which is like also a kind of a higher familiarity with that layer. So that is different from, that's like there's this big rock in the landscape. So
but things do pass through it, it's like this rock is covering the lake, and like the rain is has to kind of infiltrate through this rock, and it comes with its minerals.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
But you still see and feel so clearly. There's a layer of certainty that it's about faking it. So what I mean by patience is, right now the rain is falling through and bringing the minerals with it. Exactly. It's a good metaphor. Eventually, all the minerals will have passed through and there's no more rock. And so it's hard to taste that taste in the water and not be disgusted or discouraged or... But meanwhile, it does rain. And the rain does dissolve the rock as it comes through. And that means the rock is on its way to fall apart. So it's not this flashy sort of honesty of like, zing, gotcha, gone. But also, we don't know. So sometimes along the way, there's dissolving. And there's like, here's the taste of the minerals. The rock is weaker. So anything can happen. Including also different capacities for feeling. So tuning into the water without the taste, the temperature of the water, for example, as a metaphor. Tuning into where the sense that a decision to fake it is one thing that's happening, and an experience of honesty is another thing that's happening, and a being loved is where I'm going to hang out. And meanwhile, these processes take their time. So that's kind of that shift from we hang out with the experience of feeling loved, and then gradually, even when we're not loved, someone hates us. So now you're in the presence of being loved, and someone makes you macaroni, and it's like, yeah, that's good. And you can feel that it's good. You can actually access the feeling good. All of those are big breakthroughs. And then, I'm just going to stay with this being loved feeling. Since that's really all a kind of a manipulation anyway. A wholesome, temporary practice that's a manipulation. I'm just going to stay at the end of the race, the finish line, feeling loved. And then that just naturally can fall apart into just love. That is... is available. It's not packaged. So, or if your subject is more on about freedom, including power, authority, action, choice, some of the words that came yesterday, it's similar. So it is free. There's freedom. And it's not, eventually it doesn't need to be packaged. We just acknowledge it is free. And so then we don't even mind that there's this big rock that has a certainty about something. It's even funny. It can be have as much certainty as it likes. It's still funny. But I'm not saying it's easy or short. But it's also not that it's only about chipping away at the rock. But it's not about not chipping away at the rock. We let the rain dissolve the rock. You don't have to chip so much. And where does the rain take you that's more fruitful? So, for example, the feeling of feeling free or feeling loved or feeling there's choice or feeling there could be power in kindness. as one thing instead of as polarized opposites. There could be power and kindness and stillness. And flow. Okay, it feels enough for now for that. Is there anything someone wants to ask or say?
What do you mean when you say being, feeling grounded or being grounded? It's not crazy.
Yeah. So what do I mean by feeling grounded?
Or ungrounded.
Right? Or ungrounded. Yeah, both. Yes. Okay. So there's maybe a few layers of it. Let's maybe talk about two. Nowadays, in research about mindfulness, there's a lot of talk about regulating or regulating the nervous system or regulating the emotions.
Visut.
So one way that could be a feeling ungrounded would be when my emotions or nervous system are not regulating or not regulated. So I feel overwhelmed, and then whatever that overwhelm, whatever our habituated way of feeling overwhelmed, which could be shutdown, it could be panic, it could be like butterflies, it could be running around, it could be I've got to have the phone. So getting to know how our system expresses dysregulation is interesting. It's not our main subject, but it's interesting. And noticing can start to catch when I start to go running around or I start to go shutting down or whatever. And then kindness can start to support another way. So another, maybe a synonym for ungrounded would be where kindness is hard to find. It's hard to access kindness. It's hard to access connection. So the gap of, I am connected, but I don't feel connected. That would be one example of ungrounded. So it's interesting in some of the research about mindfulness. So the research about practicing, oh yeah, I'm breathing and I can feel it. Practicing, oh, there's feet and I can feel them. Oh, there's thinking and I notice that. Is mindfulness helps regulation. And I think one of the ways that it helps is that we discover that we're not alone. That we're not in isolation. But we discover it experientially. I'm not saying we think about that. So it might be more of an internal interdependence. So coming into mindfulness, anyone, whoever feel, okay, like whatever you feel, letting yourself feel it. whatever you see, noticing that you see it. The seeing and the noticing of the seeing, or the feeling and allowing feeling to be felt, we can call inner interdependence. There's several factors coming together for that to happen. And if there's too much of a me who thinks I'm making this happen, and it's me and my experience, there's not much mindfulness. There's not much room left. We kind of squeeze out the space for the mindfulness. So that if we can call inner interdependence, there's sensation, the capacity to feel the sensation, and kind of, let's say, space where that can come together and be acknowledged. And then because mindfulness is very literal, and then the body is very literal, so let's say I'm aware of breathing. I don't have to think about the fact that when I breathe out, that thing that was my body is now not in my body anymore. But I'm actually living an experience where my body is not airtight. Obviously, that would not be very pleasant. Sorry?
But the airtight.
I was saying, the body is literal, and the breath, we literally do breathe out, and so what was literally in here is literally now not in here anymore. It's out there. So what was my body? My body is out there. And then I said, I was joking, like, our body is not airtight. It's not like a Ziploc bag sealed shut. And I was just laughing, of course, we wouldn't want. But we, like, our conditioning is we have a little bit of an issue of not being airtight. Our conditioning is to experience as if we are airtight, as if we are sealed shut. And so the actual breath that actually isn't air, it's actually my body is now outside of my body. So is yours. And they're actually now touching each other. And then that's actually coming back, and your body just came into my body. And then not to mention how many other bodies it's been through. A part of us can think that's fun, a part of us can think it's disgusting, or like, ooh, or whatever. But it undermines our sense of being a separate hero or heroine on our individual path. And I think that it helps us, mindfulness of the fact, actually the literal ongoing fact that we're not just in here. Through simple mindfulness of breathing, or just even of the body, because the body is made of also of water and food, etc., from out there. The body is made from air also. I think it also gives us access to the way that there's interpersonal regulation. The regulation of our emotions and nervous system can be interpersonal. So one example of that is it's easier to be calm around a calm person. Usually, we might feel intimidated or whatever, they can read my mind or something like that. But in general, still, it's like, well, they don't seem to be freaked out about what they read in my mind, so maybe it's not the end of the world. And when someone is really ungrounded, it's easy to be reactive to that. to judge it, to whatever, to be interested in it, to be, get me away from that, whatever, to be reactive. So maybe that's enough said about that, but it's, because it's more important experientially to feel that we are practicing together. We're not practicing alone, and yet there's an aloneness in our practice. So the interdependence and dependence. So I want to just give a little bit more of an answer to your question, what other examples of grounded, ungrounded. Grounded is here. So ungrounded is I'm absent. Grounded is more simple, simplicity. Ungrounded would be where we're more tuned into complexity, complication, fragmentation. So it can happen that we notice what fragmentation feels like and just accept that it's happening. It's a lot about acceptance, actually, which has to do with trust and openness. That, okay, there's fragmentation happening. And we can be grounded. We can be here. We can be okay. So ungrounded is more like tuning into lack, the lacky pop, and grounded would be more, well, it's okay. There's okayness anyway. Okay. I have a question now for you. I'd like to hear about an experience of joy. How would you describe? Not what happened, but the experience of joy. What did you notice? How did you know you were joyful? What was it like? Not why you were joyful, but the joy itself. And sort of, if you know there's no way you're going to speak out loud, so at least like really devote yourself inwardly to feeling what I'm talking about. And that also helps the conversation instead of like, I'm not talking.
The first thing that came up to my mind is the joy is energy. You suddenly feel energy.
Okay. Can you describe? So she's saying when she feels joy, there's energy, and her hand is above in her upper chest, gathering together like this, like this, like that. Here, okay. Could you say, other than what your hand said, more? Can you describe more than what your hand described, which is a lot, about that energy? Because energy could be so many things.
It's vitality, it's a passion to live. Comparing to other times that there are more despair or, less energy. So this passion to live.
Okay. Can you describe passion to live in terms of sensation?
I feel very light.
Okay, so she's saying light.
Yeah.
Light. And her hand is like this, up and down,
like
in the middle.
Almost flying.
Almost flying.
Yeah.
Okay.
Something is very clear in my mind.
Okay. So clear in her mind.
I feel connected to people.
Okay. And connected.
Yeah.
To people, she said. Okay. Okay. Great. Thank you. Yes, please.
A sense of warmness.
A sense
warm.
Of
being warm.
Warm. Okay, cool. Warm. Do you notice warm sort of everywhere or somewhere?
More chest and belly, this area.
Okay, so chest and belly. Anything else that comes to mind?
Relaxation also.
Mm-hmm. And do you notice relaxation particularly somewhere or in general?
Something that is not exist, like there is nothing that buries, stops me, like openness.
Cool. Could you hear that?
Mm-hmm.
Great. Thank you. Beautiful. Yes. Anat?
I think to me joy is about flux.
Flux.
Flux, mm-hmm. Yeah. It's something that I've recently discovered, the ability to flow. For example, it just happened some days ago that I started the day being a bit despondent, allergic even, and I could carry it and just move to a better experience.
Mm-hmm.
And that in itself, the movement,
mm-hmm.
made me quite joyous.
Mm-hmm. And after the movement, still feeling some flow, some sense of flow? Is that it sounds like? Anything else that you can remember? In your face or chest or anywhere, feet or back?
This elan vital, this what this lady described, this feeling of livelihood, of living, actually.
And if your cells would describe what elan vital acts like on them or in them, is there any word for that that comes now? Maybe it doesn't.
Just the opposite of rigidity. It's the opposite of constriction. It's opening.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I like how both of you were like not quite wanting to use a word like openness.
Yeah.
Because that almost is too heavy maybe to describe the kind of opening, the not constriction.
It's too aspirational. I'm not there yet.
Well, but in that experience, that was your experience. I'm not saying that now you're permanently feeling in flow. But you had an experience that you're describing.
Yeah. And the thing is that I wasn't like head over heel, but in itself, the ability, the new found ability to move was quite amazing.
Yeah. Okay, there was another hand back there, I think. Nope. Okay. I'd like to suggest that, first of all, there's some research that indicates a tendency for us to give a lot more attention to what's difficult than to what feels good. It's interesting that at the same time, there's also research that indicates that we also tend to tell a story about ourselves that's more positive. You wouldn't know it by facing your inner critic today, but that's sort of in denial about important things. that shit that we didn't want to have to work on, and we're so happy when someone tells us you're already free. That sort of thing. Where we don't feel we are capable of being responsible for that because it doesn't respond to our efforts. All that's... So it can be helpful for now, if you like, to, for now, ignore the stories that are going on about you in your mind, but to practice feeling those good feelings and going in detail to feeling them. So like, maybe how is your back in the feeling of joy, both in memory, like we don't have to wait till we feel joyful and then try to catch it and be like, okay, how are my shoulder blades? But if possible, sometime when there is some feeling kind of good or even okay or even neutral, to actually not to analyze it, but to let your system come in contact with it finer and finer and finer. Is it warm? Is it cool? Is it heavy? Is it light? Is it moving? Is it still? Is it all of those somehow? It might not fit into our normal categories. That changing experience. And that kind of, it partly helps us get the hang of a movement. It's kind of like opening the book so we can actually maybe read it or write it, whatever you prefer. Getting the hang of opening. Getting the hang of a deeper, more subtle inner yes to life that doesn't know where it's going. It's not like, oh, now I know what my purpose is. My purpose is to do this such and such kind of work, and I mentally agree that that's good work, and I agree that I'm worthy to do that work, and let's do it, and now I can feel okay. That's the macaroni thing, which might be an important experiment to go through so that you can land in, I'm already okay, and now what? But it's this kind of opening that people are describing that's like, it's not heavy, it's not constricted. It's not stuck. I guess you could call it open, that kind of language. And I'd also like to suggest that that is a kind of experience where there is less about me. In other words, there's less about my hurts and my way of coming from and through my hurts. There's less about that manipulation that anyway makes us unhappy. And then this may help us start to make friends with times where there's suffering. But what if we start from joy and get to know how does that feel in the body and practice feeling that? And it can also be in a meditation. You don't have to think about joy, but just anywhere in the body that feels good or okay. How about starting for the first 5 minutes there? And just receiving that. And what makes up that feeling okay or good or pleasant? And how does tuning into that then affect and ripple through the mind and also our approach to meditation? And then having some momentum with being able to notice that there is something okay or good right now, and I can feel it, and I can feel it in detail, just directly, not its story. It really, it's like having the wind in our sails so that when the hard times come, we already have some momentum and experience and more subtle feeling capacity that we're familiar with. And I'd like to suggest that it might be similar in one way, the times of difficulty. The times of difficulty, often what's challenging is that there's friction against what I think I am. I remember when my son was really little and I didn't get much sleep and I couldn't get much done, and I was still running the nonprofit and still teaching retreats almost every month in different countries. from the time he was 3 months old. My mother should have told me to do something different, but. But mostly what was hard is that I couldn't do or get what I wanted when I wanted it. And it's not to say, oh, that's all, it's not a big deal. I couldn't sleep as much as I wanted to, when I wanted to, where I wanted to. I could only sleep here and there, like, okay, someone, he's with someone for 20 minutes, wherever. And often in the middle of the 20 minutes, mommy, once he could speak, or whatever, something would happen. And so it was hard, but why it was hard is interesting. And I think it's important to feel where our willingness is, our willingness to stay through it anyway. Not because we think we should, but because we're the only one who can be there in our life. We're the only us. So, like, I'm his only biological mom. There's not any other one. Being that for our own presence in our own life, our own groundedness, our own here-ness. That because we care, even though we don't want to care that much. But somehow, unfortunately, when it's about myself, my own presence in my own life, we actually don't care. We don't have that much willingness as we might for a baby. And so bringing this mothering quality to our practice and to our showing up in our lives. That we didn't even know how willing we were. And even when I'm not willing, I find myself following through anyway. More because of love and not so much because of should. The should doesn't have that staying power. And then we can allow the difficult situations also to kind of start shaving off the unnecessary. One of my teachers used to use the metaphor of leaving your head at the door. So we can let the difficult situations as well as the joy take off our head. Gradually whittle it, sand it away. And so it's coming into a way of working lightly with how things work. So, for example, sometimes there's joy, sometimes there's difficulty. But both can be brought to work against those things that, what did you say, bury? He said, he gave the word bury. I feel it's not burying, it's unburying. It's not covering up, it's uncovering. So letting difficult and joyful times uncover. And uncover and uncover until it, what's going to be left? What am I left with? How am I going to live with nothing? And then that idea about nothing also gets sort of knocked off. And still, we're like, yeah, but how? How to live without a head in this metaphorical sense? Or we could say, how to let thinking find its proper place, if you like. How to let thinking come not from worrying even one drop, but to come from the juicy drops of caring. So I'd just like to end with a poem, if I may, by Lucille Clifton. She was a U.S. poet. The title is Mother Tongue to the Child Just Born. Do you understand that phrase, mother tongue? Do you have that?
Svat M.
Svat
M.
It's short, and there'll be some words that we'll need to maybe go back to, but I'll maybe read it first once, just through. It's all small letters. There's not any capital letter, just to get the feeling on the page. If I were eloquent in your language, I would try to tell you how it is when something difficult loves you. How it is when you begin to love it back. How this can cost you everything. So really there's one difficult word, eloquent. Maybe we can just translate it to Hebrew instead of trying to explain. I couldn't really hear to repeat it. Could you all hear? Or it just means, if I were really good in your language. If I were good in your language.
Rahut. Rahut.
So if I were rahut in your language, I would try to tell you. So she gives the impression that it probably wouldn't work to use words. But if we could come to that mother tongue, some other kind of experiential language. So where we're here to experience an inner shift that really only you can recognize and grow to allow. And it's a long, difficult journey. Like there's that big rock, patience. So if I were rahut in your language, I would try to tell you how it is when something difficult loves you. And this is just, even that would be enough really for today. A turning around, which is what happens when we go from practicing the feeling of being loved or being free already. And then that falls apart too. And we're just left with love, which is this huge responsibility and huge freedom and huge gift. The generosity is already too much for us, much less me. You're putting me in charge of all that love. So letting the path love you, let's say. How it is when something difficult loves you. We could almost say how it is when you start to realize and acknowledge that it's something difficult that loves you, that calls you, that you belong to. Your path. Oh, something difficult. The text made it sound so lovely. And they said it's just so too easy. The problem is that it's too easy. But actually, when something difficult loves you, how it is when you begin to love it back. That's where it's like, oh, shit. I wanted to have a real life. Or I want it to be a real whatever. I have such good intentions. I want it like that. But then we realize that there's not this menu that we're ordering from. Or as one teacher said, you don't eat the menu. Well, we do. We try to eat the menu. But anyway, it's not food. So if I were rahut in your language, I would try to tell you. If I were eloquent in your language, I would try to tell you how it is when something difficult loves you. How it is when you begin to love it back. How this can cost you everything. So I didn't get to the story, the simple story. I was so relieved that it was like, oh, good, there's this simple story. Tomorrow, maybe. So I am going to just do one more line, even though it's long. Our potential, our capacity to be brought into through this being loved and loving of our path, responding to our call, noticing that we're at our best and it seems to really fit us when there's that élan vital. When we're unburying. Through that, starting to love being unburied. So in English it can be confusing, because bury could be a berry on a bush. So unburied in the sense of burying, put underground, covered with dirt, and unburying, taking the dirt off, discovering. Through being loved by a path that we are chosen by, and then beginning to love that, even though it's difficult, we can be brought into a way of living that is harmonious with the way things work, instead of in constant conflict with the way things work. And part of the way things work is that conditions change all the time. And conditions are not ownable. They're not owned by anyone. There's not that this part owns its parts, but it is part of. And to keep noticing that we keep sort of throwing ourselves up against a wall. Yesterday you mentioned when the thinking comes on, I'm unhappy. When the thinking is loud or dominant, I'm unhappy. And I notice, that I turn to the thinking, to the controlling thinking, for comfort, but it's not comforting. We keep throwing ourselves up against that wall and not allowing ourselves to simply feel that this hurts, first of all. That hurts. That's an internal mechanism. That's hard for us to take because it makes us feel, oh, it's my fault then. Not only am I suffering, but it's my own fault that I'm suffering. So unwinding that. And then, not only does it hurt, but, interesting. I'm looking for comfort. That's interesting. And I'm looking for comfort where there isn't comfort. That's interesting. And I start to kind of, just the system experientially understands that is not comforting. And it stops turning to that. We're still here with like the looking for comfort, looking for macaroni thing. And we need to do whatever we need to do. Looking for comfort where there is comfort, until we're not looking for comfort anymore. We look for comfort, for soothing, for grounding, for regulation, for safety. We do. And when that's what we're looking for, let's be honest about it. Not pretending I'm looking for spiritual liberation when I'm looking for safety. My system is looking for safety. It needs safety. Let it have some safety. Don't worry. That's not a dead end. Look, I'm looking for safety. I know I'm looking for safety. I acknowledge I'm looking for safety. And I find some sense of safety. Okayness, regulation. What happens next? My love of freedom is totally alive. And I'm going for it, whether I like it or not. And then I feel unsafe again. And at first I turn to the controlling mind and bang. It's long, it's hard, but it's an unburying. It's an uncovering, discovering of when there's enough ground, enough soothing, enough safety, enough being met, enough macaroni. We don't have to do that other part that loves to be alive, although life is dangerous. And we don't have to make it up that something in us knows freedom is more important than safety. That's what happens. Thank you for your patience. Bon appétit.